Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour of the program, what do we know about possible ties between President Donald Trump, his administration, and Russia? This story has been put on hold for a little while as the Senate and House are in recess, so there won't be too much investigation going on the part of the two committees that are looking at this. Plus, we have the whole Syria airstrike and tough talk now against Vladimir Putin and Russia. What does that do to the whole investigation? Our guest this hour has been writing about this for Foreign Policy. Our guest has been writing about cyberspace and its conflicts and controversies. He wrote a recent piece about Nunes facing an ethics inquiry, who stepped down from the Russian probe, the House probe, that is. And now we have other House Intelligence Committee chairs. Will they be impartial? Is it possible for them to conduct an independent, fair, and thorough investigation? We'll talk about that. We'll also be looking at the number of people who have ties to Russia. We will look at Jared Kushner and his meeting with a Russian bank, but the bank has very close ties to Vladimir Putin and has been under sanction. Jared Kushner's meeting with the head of VEB is the name of the bank, what that was all about, and how long it might be before we see some results of all of these investigations. Is there more than circumstantial evidence at this point in time? We have as our guest this hour Elias Kroll. He's a staff writer at Foreign Policy, covering cyberspace, as I said, and its conflicts and controversies. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Many of you have been following this story very closely. We welcome your thoughts, your questions about this. And our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Elias, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, hi. Great to have you here. We have a lot of territory to cover. Let's start with this whole Russian change in tone toward Russia now on the part of the Trump administration as a result of the chemical weapons event in Syria and our strike against Syria. Eric Trump said today, I believe, or late yesterday, if there was anything that Syrian strike did, it was to validate the fact that there is no Russia tie. What do you make of that statement?
Well, the background conversation to this investigation about into Donald Trump's campaign and its ties to Russia and the Russian campaign to influence the election in his favor was always this idea that the Trump administration was going to pursue a rapprochement with Russia, that they were going to try to normalize relations with Russia, that there was maybe going to be an alliance between Russia and the United States to fight the Islamic State in Syria, and to perhaps team up on a whole host of other strategic issues, if you will, right? And the Syrian strike has, of course, completely soured relations between Russia and the United States. We are now in a situation where the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is calling the Russians incompetent for not being able to prevent this attack from being carried out in the first place. So we now have a shift in the way that the Trump administration appears to be approaching Russia, from pre-inauguration, trying to seek a rapprochement, an improving of ties between the United States and Russia, to now a moment of possible conflict between the two countries.
And some have said that it just seems to the reason for this change seems to be because this administration, some of his have suggested, is under investigation, and so all of a sudden we have a change and a strike in Syria. Is that too cynical a look at what happened last week?
It seems to me that anything is possible in this administration, and we don't have a great degree of clarity on who is making these decisions inside the White House. We haven't heard from President Trump on this issue now in several days. He's dispatched his lieutenants to talk about it on various Sunday shows, and they're giving very different messages. You have somebody like Nikki Haley staking out, the UN ambassador that is staking out a very hawkish position, and then you have other advisors taking a softer tone. And it's unclear who among these advisors is speaking on behalf of the president, if any of them are, or if Donald Trump himself has his mind made up as to what he's trying to achieve as the end goal of this military operation that he's launched, or if he even knows what the end goal itself is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real lack of clarity on this issue, and Donald Trump is the man who's making these decisions at the end of the day, and if President Trump doesn't have the answers to these questions, well, then it's difficult for us in the media to try to answer these questions as well. The best we can do is read the tea leaves. And when we read the tea leaves today, we get a lot of different mixed messages. But we can say bottom line that, you know, the United States and Russia is headed towards a moment of possible conflict and confrontation over this issue. How that is going to play out in Syria, how that is going to play out in the relationship between the United States and Russia is at this moment pretty unclear.
Yeah. So how does it play out in the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee looking into possible collusion between the Trump administration and Russia?
Well, I think they're going to be looking at this very skeptically. And you know, I think they will see the tweet from Eric Trump and say, if there is, in fact, collusion that occurred between the Trump campaign and Russia in this campaign to influence the outcome of the U.S. election, then, and now we then see the president's son trying to deflect attention away from it or trying to downplay the notion that there was collusion as a result of a major military operation being launched in the United States. This is a very explosive question that congressional investigators will now have to look at. Was the Syria strike launched as a result, as an attempt to try to deflect attention away from questions of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia? We don't know the answer to that question, and it will be an extremely hard question to answer, and it represents an extreme test for, you know, the soundness of American institutions. This goes to very basic questions about the nature of the American government and whether the congressional branch is able to hold the executive to account.
Mm.
Only time will tell if they're able to do so.
And will the House and the Senate even ask that question? Will Syria be in the purview of the investigation?
That question has so far, to my knowledge, not been among the questions that has been addressed in what investigators call the scoping documents. So investigators in both the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees running separate investigations have agreed on a framework through which they're going to pursue this investigation, a series of questions that they're going to answer. As far as I know, the Syria question has not been a part of those documents, but I would be very surprised if, at the very least, Democrats don't try to bring this issue up moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And where is this investigation? They're on recess, aren't they? So nobody will be meeting about anything for a couple weeks?
I think you still have staff work moving forward on this. I think that this is a high priority for the intelligence committees, and you have staff work being carried out independent of the members themselves being in town. What's happened now is that where we are at this point is that the committees have received a large volume of documents from the intelligence community. We're talking about thousands of pages of documents that they are now combing through. These documents constitute the raw intelligence reports that served as the basis of the intelligence community assessment issued in October, saying that the Kremlin is trying to interfere in the U.S. election, and then the later report in January that fleshed some of those things out and definitively said that this was an operation ordered by the Kremlin to try to benefit Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. I believe Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, has said in the last few days that Republicans and Democrats have agreed on a list of witnesses who will appear before the House committee. Do we know who those people are?
We know some things about them. We know more about the witness list for the Senate Intelligence Committee than for the House Intelligence Committee investigation, but they're probably going to be talking to many of the same people. The Senate Intelligence Committee has said that the bulk of the witnesses that they have come up with so far are the analysts within the intelligence community who wrote the assessment about Russian interference in the election. So these are staffers at the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, mostly intelligence analysts who consume large amounts of raw intelligence and then distilled it into this report that constitutes the analytic judgment of the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm. We have three new heads of the House Intelligence Committee, with Nunes having to step aside and to face some ethical inquiry. I'm going to ask what you think about these people. Let's just hear from Trey Gowdy, Republican from South Carolina, who is now one of the heads of the Republican side of the House Intelligence Committee. Here's what he said about Russia.
All of this is important, John, every bit of it. Russia's not our friend. They attacked our democracy. I want to investigate every fact that is related thereto. But the felonious dissemination of classified information is the only thing we know for sure is a crime, and it would be nice if we showed the same level of interest in that.
Felonious information, we've heard that from a number of Republicans. Do you imagine that that will be the primary focus of Gowdy and the other Republican heads of the Intelligence Committee?
Only time will tell. They will certainly try to make it a focus. Whether it will be the main focus, that we'll see. The pursuit of leaks of classified information has been the strategy that the Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee have settled upon in order to try to distract the focus of the investigation away from the Trump administration's ties to Russia and possible collusion with the Kremlin. That much is obvious. That's not to say that there isn't a matter to be investigated when it comes to the leak of classified information, but this is without a doubt a clearly politically calculated move by congressional Republicans, including and perhaps chiefly by Trey Gowdy.
Mm-hmm. And Gowdy was the head of the Benghazi investigation, wasn't he?
He was. He was the leader of the so-called Select Committee that investigated the attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi. That was an investigation that dragged on for several years, spent millions of dollars, and at the end of the day could not find any evidence of wrongdoing on the part of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And Republican leaders in the House or in the Congress essentially admitted that this was a political effort to try to damage the woman that they knew would be their opponent in the upcoming election. And arguably they succeeded in doing that.
Mm-hmm. And Nunes is now under investigation for his run to the White House a few weeks ago. Who's investigating him? An ethics panel or who?
Yeah, this is a House ethics panel that's investigating him. It's basically an internal watchdog. Some left-wing activist groups have filed complaints with this body, and he is now being investigated. The matter that's being investigated is disclosure of classified information by Devin Nunes himself, which is quite ironic given that Nunes was really the architect of the Republican strategy to focus on the issue of leaks in this Russia investigation rather than on the substantive matter of Russia ties themselves. But no matter. So Nunes has recused himself from this investigation, and he will be investigated as to whether he inappropriately disclosed classified information in describing intelligence reports that he claims included the names of Trump lieutenants and perhaps included surveillance of Trump lieutenants themselves. This goes to the issue of so-called unmasking, which is, in an intelligence report, when a U.S. person is named, the identity of that person is redacted unless somebody within the administration requests that that name be unredacted, which can be done for national security reasons. And the argument that Nunes and his allies are making is that the Obama administration, during its waning days, carried out a politically motivated effort to try to unmask the names of Trump lieutenants in U.S. intelligence reporting whose names had previously been redacted.
Mm-hmm. Well, that story about Susan Rice was front and center for about a couple days, but now it's pretty much disappeared. What does that mean?
It's hard to parse exactly why the Susan Rice story has disappeared. Trump mentioned it himself. He accused Susan Rice in an interview in the Oval Office with the New York Times of having committed crimes without specifying what those crimes were that she had committed. It seemed as if for a moment there that the Republicans were going to really focus on Susan Rice and try to make her the boogeyman, which of course they've done before. But so far, that hasn't really happened. That seems to have taken a back seat so far. And the issue of unmasking, whether the unmasking was inappropriate, has not been definitively settled by any means. And I'm sure it will be another one of the issues that these congressional committees, their investigations will have to address, which, as you can imagine, the more issues you pile onto these investigations, the longer they are going to take. The more questions that these investigations have to settle,
right,
it's going to drag that process out.
Yeah, there are so many different areas for exploration. I would imagine it's going to be pretty lengthy. What about this? This is just one of the latest. We'll go through many others during the course of the hour. What about this meeting that Jared Kushner, who's really doing all aspects of government these days, he meets with the head of this Russian bank, but it's that has very close ties to Putin, that's under sanctions and has been for the past 3 years, VEB, I don't know if we call it VEB, I don't know who this guy was, why he met with him, and why he didn't disclose when he was getting national security clearance that he had met with this guy.
It's a great question why Jared Kushner met with the head of this bank. It's called Veneshekonom Bank. It's a Kremlin-owned State Development Bank. The board of this bank is composed of Russian government ministers. It's essentially a slush fund for the use of the Russian government. Anytime they want to finance a project that is politically important or is personally important to Vladimir Putin, Veneshekonom Bank is one of the first places they go. It was one of the main financiers of the Sochi Olympics. It's used to shower money on governors that are close to the Kremlin, including the leader of the province of Chechnya, which is led by a brutal governor by the name of Ramzan Kadyrov, who's put down a radical Islamist insurgency there. And Veneshekonom Bank has been used in Ukraine to spread Russian influence in Ukraine ahead of the 2014 ouster of the pro-Kremlin president of that country. It's used in Belarus in order to support that Russian ally. Belarus, of course, is best known for being Europe's last dictatorship. VEB is essentially a very convenient, muscular financial instrument for the Kremlin to use for its political ends. And the head of this bank, which is sanctioned by the United States, had a meeting with Jared Kushner, son-in-law to Donald Trump, and an advisor with an almost all-inclusive portfolio, and then he failed to disclose that meeting in forms that he's required to submit in order to obtain a security clearance. Jared Kushner, of course, is represented by one of the best lawyers in Washington, a woman named Jamie Gorelick, who is extremely experienced in these kinds of matters and would understand the implications of having had such a meeting. And yet, Jared Kushner did not disclose it. Why he did not? We do not know. You said it was an oversight.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, and I'm not sure how many of these have happened, in the last couple of days, another Russian hacker was busted in Spain. Evidently, it's part of a global dragnet, which you probably know something about. At least six Russians, I have read, were arrested in Europe. And this 32-year-old Russian computer programmer called his wife, and she told the press that her husband told her the arrest was linked to Trump's election win. What do you know about that?
Right. Well, so there's been a lot of headlines in the last couple of days claiming that a Russian hacker linked to the Russian campaign to influence the election was arrested in Spain. It has not been confirmed that this man, Levashov, I believe his name is, was actually linked to that campaign. The origin of that information, as you said, was a quote from his wife. His wife said that she had spoken to her husband and said that her husband had told her that he had been arrested because of his alleged involvement in that influence operation against the U.S. election. We don't know to what extent that man, that hacker, was actually involved in that operation. What we do know is what the U.S. authorities have alleged, which is that this hacker operated what's known as a botnet, which is essentially a network of thousands of computers that are controlled after having been infected by malicious software, and that network of computers can then be put to nefarious ends. You can do all sorts of fun things with a botnet, including take down sites, funnel traffic, steal information and data, that sort of thing. And this hacker was very well known. He's he's known as one of the kings of the Russian spam business. Now, Russian intelligence has close links with the cyber criminal underground in Russia. Russian intelligence will at times outsource their operations to this criminal underground and put criminal hackers to work on its behalf. This gives them access to a cadre of extremely talented hackers, and it also gives them a measure of deniability because these operations are carried out and Russia can say, this wasn't us, we didn't do this, this was a criminal who carried out this operation. So whether there was a relationship between this hacker and the Russian government, we do not know yet. The U.S. government has not said yet whether they believe that to be the case.
Oh, there are so many...
Sure, they're asking him right now.
Right. There are so many parts to this story, aren't there?
It's never ending. It's never ending. Absolutely. I've never covered a story like this.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Elias Kroll is our guest, staff writer at Foreign Policy. He's written quite a few articles about possible coordination, collusion, whichever word you prefer, between the Trump campaign and Russia. Wherever you want to go with this story, what you understand is being investigated, whether or not you think that much ado is being made about nothing, or if it's something that's bigger than Watergate. What do you think this whole serious story does to the Russian investigation? It is interesting that Eric Trump did say if there was anything that Syria strike did, it was to validate the fact that there is no Russia tie. It's interesting that he said that yesterday or today. Well, what do you make of all of it? What needs to be investigated? What do you make of what we know so far? 800-486-8655. Do you think that the House and the Senate will get to the bottom of this? Do you think the FBI will be getting to the bottom of this? 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to read your comments all the time, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network.
But I've been around this town long enough to know when there's something of these consequences and this enormity, there's always additional information that comes out before it's concluded. And we're already seeing that, by the way, this morning with the, quote, allegations that there was coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And I've seen them before, Matt, and so there's more to come.
Senator John McCain, way back, it seems like a long time ago, in March, talking about this very issue. We have phone calls now. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. Valerie in Milwaukee is our first caller for you. Hi, Valerie.
Hello.
Hi.
Kathleen, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a comment, and I'm really glad that you have Ilya on your program this morning, because we need to keep the focus on this investigation, because lots of people want to forget about it. But I think also it's extremely interesting that Eric Trump made that comment, because many of us were thinking the same thing in the opposite form of Trump did this just to distract us and to make it look like he was not a friend of Russia. But I don't believe that for a minute. So that's my comment.
Thank you. Well, we know more about what our relationship is after Tillerson's meeting. I don't know if he's going to meet with Putin tomorrow or not, but after his trip to Moscow, Elias?
Well, so far, Tillerson has been snubbed from Putin's schedule.
Right.
He hasn't been given the time of day. We'll see if Tillerson manages to get on there. I think it's pretty unlikely that that's going to happen, but we will definitely know more about the shape of U.S.-Russian relations after this meeting with Tillerson, who, of course, himself has a long history in Russia. As
right.
head of ExxonMobil, he brokered several major energy deals between his company and Russia. He was given a Medal of Friendship by Vladimir Putin himself. So he has some experience there. We'll see if he's able to convert that business experience into some diplomatic savvy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find out.
We go to Joanne in Appleton next. Hi, Joanne.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call, Captain.
Sure.
And guest. My comment is this. Knowing that the capabilities of the Russians to hack into our systems is so incredibly genius, if you will, For us to have counted ballots in, I think, two states and not have looked into the hacking into the electronic voting systems in every state, I find that to be just astonishing that we haven't looked into that, because we know that those can be compromised. We've seen that from previous elections.
Do you have worries that they may have been, or do we have no evidence of that at all, Elias?
We have no evidence that the actual voting machines themselves were tampered with, or that the vote, or that the machines used to count votes, for example, were tampered with. There have been computer science professors who have showed that voting machines are notoriously vulnerable and that they can be broken into. There was evidence in the campaign that Russian hackers probed and perhaps broke into the voter registration database systems in Arizona and in Illinois. Now, government officials say that there was no evidence that there was actual vote tampering going on by the Russians. They say that because the American voting infrastructure is so diverse and spread out and it uses different machines, that a coordinated campaign to try to swing the results of the election would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to pull off. But what you'll notice in that statement is that the government strategy isn't necessarily to secure voting machines, but rather to rely on the diversity of weaknesses in the voting machine infrastructure in order to make sure that there is no coordinated campaign to try to swing the results of an election by hacking it. That is something that absolutely dismays computer security experts, and they cannot believe that this is the government's approach.
Hmm. Going back to what the strategy would be with this administration, if indeed a lot of people in your administration have had significant links to and made a lot of money from doing various things with Russia. I mean, some of these people, Manafort, Michael Flynn, others got paid royally for the work that they did on behalf of the Russian regime and on behalf of Putin. Why would you risk, and the amount of money that Donald Trump has made from Russian oligarchs who have purchased his property, why would you run the risk of what could conceivably become a war with Russia? And you would lose all of those financial ties that you had once you're out of office. Why would you do that?
That's a good question. I think Donald Trump is clearly dismayed by and really worried by these headlines about his administration's ties to Russia and the possibility of collusion between his lieutenants and the Kremlin. He thinks that this story is an attempt to undermine his legitimacy, that this is a conspiracy by the Democrats who are upset about having lost the election, and they've latched on to this Russia story to try to discredit Trump and undermine his legitimacy, basically. And Donald Trump is somebody who takes that very personally and very much wants to fight back against those accusations and wants to put them to rest. And they have so far dominated the early months of his administration. They have undermined his strategic priorities, and getting back on track and getting away from this story is very important to him. So I think that Donald Trump will be willing to take a wide range of different actions in order to try to put this to bed and get his administration back on track and to get people to stop talking about Russia.
Mm. Thanks very much, Joanne, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the possible Russian connections between the Trump administration and Russia and putting into the mix the airstrikes, U.S. airstrikes in Syria, and how that makes this whole situation not front page news anymore and perhaps more complicated, trying to examine, although we don't know the answer, the reasons for the strikes. And some have suggested they were related to the news headlines being dominated by the Russia story. Marion Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Well, on the point you just made, I really believe he is going to send us into a war with Korea, because if we go into a war with Korea and anything happens that finds him guilty, there's no way in Hades people would have an appetite to impeach a president at that point, because if they did, our country would go into a mass chaos.
Liz?
Donald Trump clearly has taken a very hard line on Korea. And exactly how he's going to approach it is, again, is shrouded in mystery. You currently have a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group heading towards the eastern coast of Korea, where it is intended that it will send a strong message to the Koreans, to the North Koreans, not to carry out another nuclear test. You have the anniversary coming up on Saturday of Kim Il-sung's birthday. That is Kim Jong-un's grandfather, the founder of North Korea. That is a day on which North Korea historically likes to test new weapons. And how the Trump administration is going to respond is very unclear, to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm.
Your caller's point about the impeachment of a president in the middle of wartime is, I think, a very good one. I think that if we are in a situation where Congress is ready and perhaps willing to consider articles of impeachment, that a state of war between the United States and North Korea would significantly undermine the political appetite on Capitol Hill to bring articles of impeachment. Now, that said, we are currently very far from Donald Trump being impeached.
How far are we from the FBI investigation being concluded? Is it a long way?
We do not know. The FBI investigation is a counterintelligence investigation, which agents who are familiar with these types of investigations say that they tend to run their own course, and how long they're going to take is very difficult to predict.
Mm-hmm.
As we said earlier in the show, there are constantly new issues, new contacts that are bubbling up on this story that
right.
the FBI and other investigators have to run to ground. And how long that is going to take, that is anyone's guess. The FBI has now apparently set up a kind of a separate unit to carry out this investigation. This is a unit that's supposed to give FBI Director Jim Comey better insight into the progress of the investigation. But how that investigation is going to end, whether it's going to end with criminal charges or something else, or whether it will just die its own slow death, we don't know at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Who do we need to hear from? The other thing, as you were saying this, I'm thinking about all the news that's happened just in the last few weeks. There's just so much coming at you that it's hard to keep up with all of this. So that this is a major strike that takes place on Syria, all the ramifications of that, what happens to how we deal with Russia, et cetera. That's the story that dominates the news now. Last week it was Russia and it was Sally Yates and Nunes and holy cow, it's just, you know, this ton of material. It's really hard to stay on track with one story. But if you were to stay on track with one story, who would you want to hear from? Who are the most important witnesses to come before, should they come before, the House or the Senate? Is Sally Yates important? Is Michael Flynn important? Is Roger Stone important? Who do we need to hear from?
I think Michael Flynn's name is probably at the top of that list. Michael Flynn was the principal foreign policy advisor and national security advisor to Donald Trump, and he clearly had contact with the Russian government. He spoke with Sergei Kislyak, the U.S. ambassador, the Russian ambassador to the United States, shortly after the announcement of sanctions by the White House in response to the Russian campaign to meddle in the U.S. election. What did Michael Flynn offer Russia in that conversation? Reportedly, Michael Flynn told the Russians not to overreact, and the Russians did not react. Typically, when the United States sanctions Russia and expels diplomatic officers who it claims are in fact intelligence operatives, Russia goes and does the same thing. There's a bit of a quid pro quo that happens there. That didn't happen when the Obama administration announced those sanctions. Was that because of promises that Michael Flynn gave to the Russian ambassador in his phone conversations? We do not know the answer to that question as of now. Sally Yates, another name you mentioned, that was the acting attorney general, may have the answer to that question. Now, is Sally Yates going to go before a congressional committee and divulge the contents of intercepted phone conversations between the Russian ambassador and the president-elect's chief national security advisor? that's a question you will have to ask Sally Yates, because it goes to, again, very core issues of individual privacy and how the United States conducts its foreign policy. At that point in time, the president of the United States was Barack Obama. But it appears that at the same time, lieutenants on behalf of President-elect Trump were making overtures to the Russian government, at least that appears to be the case, that may be in violation of a law known as the Logan Act. Now, that law has never been prosecuted, and federal prosecutors say that, you know, they're very skeptical that a case could ever be brought under that law. But you have, as I'm alluding to here, several explosive issues that could result in criminal charges that speak to who, in fact, was running U.S. foreign policy in the space between November, and January 20th, Inauguration Day. This was a time when the United States was attempting to respond to a Russian campaign to meddle in the U.S. election. Were Trump lieutenants at that time undermining that effort? That is a question that Michael Flynn is probably best positioned to answer.
Exactly. Our number is 800-486-8655. Claude in Madison. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
Wonderful. I'm so glad you picked me today, because I've been trying to, from time to time, I've tried to intervene, but I was cut off by the time I get there. Now, my comment is this. I have come to America after I have fled away from political fights in my country. And it is a common, typical way that those leaders do in Africa when they are back to the wall by the population. What they do is they start a war somewhere, and everybody is obliged to line behind them to fight the war, and they forget the bad that they did. And that's what I'm seeing here. It's just that. Wiretapping is debunked. All the names that they have brought out, debunked. And remember, Michael Flynn, as soon as he was fired, he tweeted one word, and I don't know if anybody remembers that. He said, "Cape goat." A cape goat is what? A goat that is sacrificed for the sin of everybody in a community. So he is the cape goat. He was sacrificed for all those people who were in this situation with him to be covered. That's what I see.
All right. Thank you, Claude, for the call. On the other hand, there are people, and there were many commentators after the strike in Syria who praised the president. Democrats praised the president. Republicans praised the president for the action in Syria, calling attention, world attention, to chemical weapons attacks, which are unconscionable. And you have to give him the benefit of the doubt that he was deeply moved by what he saw, and he wanted to make a statement to the world that we won't tolerate this. So there's that element. What do you think about that, Elias?
I think Donald Trump is probably speaking from the heart when he says that he was deeply moved by the images of Syrian children dying in a chemical attack. I don't think that there is any reason to really doubt that that is the case. Now, we have seen American allies line up in support of this strike.
Right.
In Europe and the Middle East, there's a sense that there was a frustration with the Obama administration for not taking sufficiently strong action in response to previous chemical attacks by the Syrian regime. I think the question is, what comes after this strike? How does this strike fit into a strategy for ending a civil war that has dragged on for 6 years?
Yes.
That has left hundreds of thousands of people dead, that have resulted in the worst humanitarian catastrophe since World War II that has sent millions of people streaming into the European Union and created a refugee crisis that is has completely upended European politics. What is Donald Trump going to do about that, and what is his next move? We don't know.
We don't know. You're right. Claude, thank you very much for your call. More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the United States and Russia, and now tossing in Syria. At the time we planned this show, we didn't have Syria in the headline, but now we have that as well. What do we know about the Trump administration and Russian ties, and how does Syria figure into all of this now as well? Elias Kroll, staff writer at Foreign Policy, who knows all of these issues, as you can tell, pretty thoroughly. He covers cyberspace and its conflicts and controversies. And we are welcoming phone calls for him on this ever-changing story. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. We have some emails coming in. We'll read those. And we're on Facebook, where we'd like to read your comments, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. We're hearing from different voices on Russia ties and also on Syria. This is Congressman Adam Schiff, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee investigating possible Russian ties between the Trump administration and Russia. He is on ABC with George Stephanopoulos on April 9, talking about Syria.
I do think also we saw just the events of the last 48 hours, why it is so important on the broader issues that the president have a responsible, respectful relationship with the intelligence community. This is the first life or death decision this president has made on the basis of intelligence that was provided to him. Now, he didn't apparently seek the support of our allies, but had he done that, he would have gone to them and said, this is what our intelligence shows. This is why we think the Russians are lying. They need to be able to believe our intelligence as the American people do. And I hope this underscored for the president why the destructive relationship he's had has to come to an end.
Let's get some emails that have come in for you. Matt in Wausau writes, with all the news surrounding Trump and Russia allegations, hasn't there been ample time to destroy evidence? Also, the Syria bombing has put the investigation on the back burner, at least relative to news coverage. Are you convinced that the evidence is still available, is still there?
There have been preservation orders that have been sent out by investigators. There has so far been no evidence that has emerged, or reports, rather, to indicate that evidence has been destroyed. As your listener writes in his email, it is absolutely a possibility. This has been going on for a long time now. I think you can be certain that the Russian agents who were involved in this campaign have gone to great lengths to try to obfuscate their role and to destroy the evidence to the extent that they have been able to. But to what extent evidence destruction has taken place is yet again, and I'm sure this must be very frustrating to your listeners to have to hear this again and again, but it is something that we don't know at this stage.
Adam in Galena, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. So my point is Putin's got the evidence, and he wants to see the United States destabilized. So he will wait until the opportune minute to dump the evidence on us to let us know that he did give Trump $200 million for this or do that. So Putin is the one in charge here. He knows Trump is a patsy, and he will dump on us when he wants to at the most opportune time for him to destabilize us.
Well, that's an interesting comment. Elias?
Yeah, that's absolutely possible. You know, there was a dossier put together by a former British intelligence agent, a man named Christopher Steele,
right,
that Russia is sitting on all kinds of compromising information regarding Donald Trump, and that it's waiting for the opportune moment to either drop that information or to use it in order to get Trump to acquiesce in his dealings with Russia. What information the Russians are sitting on remains unconfirmed. Whether they're sitting on that information remains unconfirmed.
Mm-hmm.
But your caller's theory that they might be sitting on such information is absolutely valid, because the use of compromising information is a long-held Russian intelligence tactic. It is something that the Russian intelligence services, going back to their Soviet roots, have perfected over the course of decades. Mm.
So what do you think? Are we on the verge of something as big as Watergate or not?
Well, I wish I had the answer to that question. We are trying to, and that is a question that just about every reporter working the story is trying to answer, to try to nail down whether there is a concrete evidence, whether there is concrete evidence of, first off, you know, collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. There is a lot of smoke there. There is so far no real fire there. And whether this story will become something as big as Watergate, I think, hinges on that question. And that is a question that so far has not been answered.
Right. Adam, thanks very much for your call. Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. This, you know, every 4 years, we have a chance to clean house. What I believe is the most destabilizing thing about the whole situation from 2010 on is we've become a nation of bullies. We have a bully in Madison. We have a bully in the White House. And it trickles down. It's acceptable. It has been shown as an acceptable mode of behavior, and it isn't. And I believe that that is what is the most destabilizing, destructive thing about the whole issue. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Anita in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. I am puzzled. I'm reminded with this alliance between Iran and Russia and Syria, I'm reminded of the Axis powers in a previous war. But I can't figure out for the life of me, perhaps your guest can shed light, on what's in it for Iran. That's mysterious to me. What's in it for them?
Well, Iran right now has an enormous opportunity, right? Sanctions are being lifted on Iran as a result of the nuclear deal. The United States has pulled out of Iraq. And its ally in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is winning its civil war there. So Iran is basically kind of on the edge of becoming a much stronger regional power. Now, how does Iran factor into the story that we've been talking about today about the Russian interference campaign, effort to interfere in the U.S. election? It doesn't really, but it figures into this bigger geopolitical game in a very important way, in that how Donald Trump is going to settle the Syrian civil war has deep implications for Iranian regional power.
When do you think we might get some explanation from the president as to what the steps forward will be? It is unusual he hasn't said anything since the airstrikes. Do you think that everybody's huddling? He has people around him who many say are doing their jobs well, and they're smart military guys. Does he have a good number of people around him who know what's going on and can come up with a good plan forward?
He does have a group of military advisors who are well-regarded and who are considered as men of acumen and learning, if you will, for lack of a better term. This is his defense secretary, Jim Mattis, former Marine general, and his national security advisor, another general, H.R. McMaster. These are two men who have been involved in America's recent wars at a both at a very high level and also on the ground leading military engagements and leading troops on the ground. And they are extremely well-regarded, they are well-read, and they really understand the kinds of political issues and dynamics that can undermine a White House and sabotage an administration. Now, as to when we're going to hear from Donald Trump, tomorrow he is going to be holding a press conference alongside the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, on the occasion of Montenegro's accession into NATO.
Mm-hmm.
This is a move that has been opposed by Russia. Montenegro, a Balkan state, former Soviet client, and that is now getting to join NATO, which is something that the Russians worked very hard to prevent. U.S. Congress had has voted overwhelmingly to allow Montenegro to join the alliance, which it now will. And tomorrow, Donald Trump will be talking alongside the NATO Secretary General.
He'll be asked about this.
Montenegro.
And thank you, Elias. We're out of time. I want to thank you so much. We'll be on this story again. You're a great guest. I hope you'll join us again.
My pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. Elias Kroll, staff writer at Foreign Policy, covering cyberspace conflicts and controversies and the Russia story. Thanks very much to Chris Molina for producing this hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. The very high cost of childcare, hour two.